The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
When I was 17, it was a very good year. It was a very good year for small town girls.
You'd struggle to find any significant books that come out of Britain about us.
And I was 17. It was a very good year.
When I started falling down, I thought, well, I must have a brain tumor. This is it. So I had my mother actually come to school.
When I was 17, it was a very good year.
I became the subject of surveillance and intimidation by the FSB, which is the successor agency to the KGB.
We'd hide from the light.
The ones who are very excited about technology have absolutely no idea what a book is and don't read.
Then I was 35. It was a very good year.
Christmas is upon us. Can it really be a year since the last one? And what happened to all those New Year's resolutions? Oh, never mind, there's always a next time, and the self-help books are already cascading into the bookshops in time to mop up all that post-festive guilt and cash. I've already taken delivery of one called Willpower, Rediscovering Our Greatest Strength, which I'm assured by advanced reviews from the US will help us all to lead better lives, be better parents, stay organised and lose weight more wisely. In our very first podcast of this past year, Oliver Berkman gave us a glimpse of the sort of thing we all have to look forward to, as featured in his boldly titled book, Help!
Well, if you go back far enough to ancient Greece and ancient Rome, there was no separation made between philosophy, self-help, psychotherapy. It was all the same job, trying to work out what was a good life, what was a happy life. We've come to this sort of splintered stage now in publishing culture, where the mind, body, spirit shelves are for a certain kind of person. But the subject matter that they're dealing with, yes, I think is universal. And there always have been and still are some great thinkers in the field. Today, we think of philosophy as something that very smart academic people do in universities, self-help as something that maybe gullible people or people who have the wool pulled over their eyes are interested in, and then therapy as something for people with serious problems. But there's no real reason, I think, to understand those three things as being so distinct. And part of what I was doing in my book was getting an excuse to indulge my part horrified, but part genuine fascination with this whole field, and the hope that there might be some decent stuff in there.
Yeah, let's come back to the book itself. Now, Sarah, describe this book to us.
I'm holding in my hand a copy of Oliver Berkman's book, and it says Help across the top, much in the manner of the Beatles single. And then it has an upside-down smile, and then you have to turn the book over to see the subtitle, which is, as Claire said before, is How to Become Slightly Happier and Get a Bit More Done.
Lots of sort of Damien Hirst dots on the back with useful sayings.
Yes, some of which. Not. How to be interesting, how to empty your inbox. I actually remember your column on that. Why everything takes longer than we expect, something that I can sympathise with.
Of course, it's based on his newspaper, your newspaper columns, isn't it?
Right, in the Guardian Weekend magazine.
I've actually pulled off the shelves a whole selection of the ones that have come in so far this year, and I just talk us through them, Oliver.
We have Paul McKenna, I Can Make You Happy. This is one of a long series of similarly big claims that he makes in the titles of his books. He's using, basically, as I understand it, the principles of something called neuro-linguistic programming, which is a big deal in the self-help world, and I think has a certain amount of common sense underneath it. It's to do with visualizing certain processes in your mind, running mental movies to try to help you feel certain ways.
And the book that I have is How Can I Ever Trust You Again? Infidelity from Discovery to Recovery in 7 Steps. This is apparently a supportive and practical guide to coping with infidelity and keeping your relationship alive. But I think my favourite thing about this one, just looking at the cover, is the quotation that they have on the back from The Times, which says, should be your new bedtime read.
Perhaps the antidote to so much manufactured happiness was our podcast devoted to writing and illness. On the optimistic side, we heard from the Reader organisation about how reading aloud can help people with mental problems. But the emotion involved in poet Sarah Manguzzo's memoir, Two Kinds of Decay, was more about endurance of extreme physical suffering.
I woke up one morning and my feet were asleep, and so, like any rational person, I thought I must have slept on them wrong or not slept long. You know, I had all of these sort of increasingly irrational explanations for this fairly odd symptom. I was tired, I had a cold, I had worn shoes that were too tight. Within a couple of days of that symptom, I started having a lot of trouble washing my face because I wasn't able to hold my breath for the couple of seconds that it would take to splash water on my face. And that was slightly more alarming, but still nothing to truly panic about. And after about a week, the numbness had started spreading up my legs. And when I started falling down, I thought, well, I must have a brain tumor. This is it. So I had my mother actually come to school, went to the emergency department and was diagnosed after about half an hour, and there it began.
In the book, you go through the treatments that you received for this illness, which sound far more horrifying, really, when you're reading it, than the initial diagnosis of the illness does, you know, this numbness. The main one that I remember from reading the book is this process called aphoresis, I think.
Aphoresis was probably the most medieval treatment that I had. And so the blood is actually removed from the body, either 1 cup at a time or continuously through a tube, and then centrifuged. It then separates into its components. And so depending on which component of your blood is ill, in my case it was the plasma, it's thrown away, replaced sort of with some attempt at an artificial substitute for it, and then replaced in the body. And like dialysis, it can be very exhausting. It can just feel very uncomfortable. For the first year or so that I was receiving it, the machine at my hospital didn't have a blood warmer, and so my blood was going back into me at room temperature. It feels cold. And so, yeah, there were many odd, strange, unpleasant sensations I'd never felt before.
In the written down version of your story, and the language that you use, it's sort of erased of emotion a lot of the time. It's as if it seemed to me reading it that you didn't want to indulge or allow yourself to sort of fall into all the emotion that I imagine it would churn up. Do you think is that a fair thing to say about it?
It is fair. And I was striving for accuracy above all else. And it wasn't so much that I didn't trust the memories of heightened emotion or the heightened emotion that I was feeling at the moment of writing it, but what was primary to the experience was just the strangeness. And so I wanted to find a way to capture those continual surprises, you know, what plasma tastes like when it's injected into your heart, because you can taste it immediately. For some reason, my apheresis nurse already knew that wintergreen candy was the one flavor that neutralized it enough on the tongue so that you didn't actually taste the plasma as it was pumped into you for 4 consecutive hours. The language, it started out rather clinical, and then I found myself needing to erase any insertions of my emotional responses in order to communicate that better.
Suffering have a positive side? Oh, yes, it can, according to singer-songwriter Christine Hirsch. In her autobiography, she explored the way that illness has fueled her creativity.
I've come to realize that what I do is sort of inherent ambient noise and retain it. if a whirring fan is in a room, I will continue to hear the whirring fan as I move away from it. And overlaid with that is the sound of a car driving by that then drives by again and again and again. So I hear the same sounds that everyone else does, but if a song is in the air, it will grab this vocabulary and eventually become a cohesive song body, which incorporates a different vocabulary. So it's a long process.
That process is amplified by, what is it? I don't know, a kind of tinnitus, which resulted from a car crash when you were run over by what you understandably describe as a witch.
Yeah. The static and industrial noise that often accompanies these sounds seems to come of its own accord, and a song always begins with that sound. I've actually tried to recreate it on records. People who suffer because they have nowhere in particular to go are those who can sit still, who sleep. I stopped doing these things last September when I made a mistake and moved into the wrong place, a bad apartment christened the Doghouse by someone who painted that on the door. The Doghouse was the last place I played music on purpose, of my own volition. I innocently stepped through the door of the Doghouse and put my stuff down because I thought that if I lived alone for a while, music might speak to me, tell me its secrets. Music spoke all right. It yelled. And as it turns out, it has no secrets. If you ask music a question, it answers and then just keeps talking louder and louder, never shuts up. Music yelled so loud and so much in the Doghouse, I can still hear it.
And the story you tell in this book is kind of, it seems to me, about a coming to an accommodation with a gift that feels at the time as much of an affliction as it is a gift.
Oh, yeah. It's way a curse. And yet I worship what comes out of it. I don't think it has anything to do with me. I think it's something that anybody could grab and turn into whatever the vocabulary happens to be. Mine was sound, I guess, because of the bump on the head, but maybe I'm oriented that way.
Now, one of the New Year titles that's been intriguing me is French Children Don't Throw Food by Pamela Druckerman, an American based in Paris. They're so well behaved, those Frenchies. Or are they? Fikre Gibbons went to find out.
I'm just outside the Salon du Livre in Paris, which is the biggest books gathering in the whole French literary calendar. It's immense. It's kind of Hay, Cheltenham, Edinburgh Books Festivals all put together and multiplied by 10. We just don't have anything at all like this in England. And it's the sort of occasion that brings English speakers out in all sorts of inferiority complexes, because we have this idea of the French as being, you know, so much more sophisticated, so much smarter, so much slimmer, so much more literate than us. But when you actually look at the figures, the French read a lot less than us. That said, France is far more open to the world than we are. Almost half the books published here are translated, whereas in England, foreign fiction accounts for less than 3% of what we read. The thing that people are really excited about this year, and the person who all the crowds here tonight have come to see, is not some sort of smart new left-bank novelist or some interestingly exotic writer from the Francophonie, from Africa or from Asia. It's actually a 93-year-old man called Stéphane Hessel, a former resistance fighter, a survivor of the camps, one of the great human rights lawyers of post-war France, a man who has had a great career 40, 50 years ago, but was kind of forgotten and has come back with this amazing little book called Indignez-vous, which means get angry, a tiny little pamphlet, which in a few days' time will have sold 2 million copies, which is just unprecedented in French publishing. And what's particularly remarkable about this book is that it's cost so little. It costs €3. And so there's a completely different audience, a completely different readership. A lot of the people who've bought it are young, they're students, they're disillusioned, and they have seen in this 93-year-old man a kind of hero.
I'm 23.
And he's 93.
Yeah, 70 years older. The thing is, writing, like in Indignez-vous and in Engagez-vous to the Hub editions, is making me understanding how we should go in politics, mondial politics and French politics. And when we see what's happening around today in Libya, this man of 93 years old is just the great one. What a good idea. because of his career and because of his life, you know. In 45, he was a member of the National Council of Resistance in France, and he was the part of the ones who ruled the country just after the end of the Second War. Stéphane Hessel can say something that some other persons can't but think as well. The thing with Stéphane Hessel is that he's completely free.
I mean, it is an angry book. It's a very angry book.
Of course, but this is an angry world.
That was Fieke Gibbons in Paris, in March rather than in April. It was, we have to say, rather a fun month, which The Guardian devoted to finding out more about our European neighbours. One of the places we stopped off was Krakow, with novelist James Hopkin.
Krakow, which other city composed a Pope and two Nobel Prize winners for literature in the last 35 years? There was Czesław Miłosz in 1980 and Wisława Szymborska in 1996. But the city is also home to the science fiction writer Stanisław Lem and the dramatist and short story writer Zławomir Mrożek, as well as the underground poet and enfant terrible of the Polish literary scene, Marcin Świetlicki. But there's also another significant name here, Józef Teodor Konrad Korzeniowski, who lived here as a child for several years. I'm making my way across the square past the long yellow cloth wall in the centre, the 14th century Sukhinitsa, recently renovated and reopened. And I'm passing the monument to Poland's most famous romantic poet, Adam Mickiewicz, who wrote the national classic, Pan Tadeusz. I'm heading to Empik, a nationwide department store, to see what the people of Poland are reading at the moment.
Number one is Jan Tomasz Gross, Golden Harvest. That's a book that came out first in English, written by a Polish sociologist and a historian. That's a book about what was happening in Poland right after World War II.
So is it, to some extent, a discussion of anti-Semitism in Poland?
To some extent, it's not really.
It's just someone in the background saying no to this book and giving us the thumbs down.
The rest of the top ten.
Let's see, we have the usual vampire romance.
There's Eric Emanuel Schmidt,
who's always very popular in
hugely popular in Poland.
I'm surprised not to see Paulo Coelho, who's also huge in Poland.
Eric Emanuel Schmidt took over his place, basically. It's the same type of literature, so yeah. I guess people switched over to him. And then there is Bartha Pawlikowska, Blondynka na Języka. She's a Polish journalist who writes lighter travelogues. And journalism is something, and travel writing is something that's been picking up recently in Poland, and she's one of the stars of the movement, writing the lighter, just travel the globe. But this is about, this particular one is about UK. Then we have Loni Swan.
Triumph of Yates.
The Triumph of the Sheep. It is down into a radio play at the moment, so that's probably why it is so widely popular. And at number 10, Janusz Leon Wiśniewski. He writes like, I guess, most female writers would like to write.
By August, we'd had enough of the Eurozone, hasn't everybody? And moved our attention to Scotland for our very first year as sponsors of the Edinburgh International Book Festival. For all its elegance, Edinburgh is an ancient city with its share of horrible history. So we sent Zan Brooks off to do a bit of scary sightseeing.
Edinburgh Castle, town and tour, God grant thou sink for sin, and that even for the Black de Noir, Earl Douglas Gat therein.
I'm Zan Brooks, and I've come to the black heart of Gothic Edinburgh, to Mary King's Close off the High Street. Outside it's lively and bustling, but now we're two flights down a set of worn stone steps. It's damp and dark, and silent as the grave. I'm here with Louise Welsh, whose forensic debut novel The Cutting Room was nominated for the Orange Prize in 2003, and whose last tale, Naming the Bones, similarly digs beneath the surface of Scottish culture.
I think this is one of my favourite places in Edinburgh. And when I was a child, we were told stories about plague victims who'd been walled up and left to die. They didn't go quietly. They cried and screamed and begged for food, but people were so frightened of the plague that they wouldn't let them out. And this is, of course, all utter nonsense. And the real Mary King's Close, the organisation here, are very eager to dispel all of these myths. And they've based their tours on a very solid historical research. And yet, as you say, we're two floors under. It's dark, it's damp. So yes, it's creepy.
Okay, we're in a very, this is a very creepy spectacle here. We've just come into a very small room with undressed walls. There's an alcove, and in the alcove, there's what I can only describe as a sort of tweeny voodoo shrine in which a lot of children's dolls are piled to the height of about 5 foot into the alcove. So there's dolls, there's Smurfs, there's teddy bears, there's stuffed rabbits. And it's peculiarly terrifying.
There's hundreds of eyes looking at you. This is a shrine. This is an unofficial, spontaneous shrine to little Annie. And I think in the early 90s, a Japanese parapsychologist or medium came down here, and she claimed to have felt the presence of a little girl called Annie, who she said was desperately missing her parents. Her mummy had left her down here because she had the plague, apparently. Annie wanted a doll. She'd also lost her doll. And this is the result. Hundreds of dolls. Last time I was down here, there were cigarettes as well. They seem to have all gone. I should say I believe in none of this, but I'm fascinated by the sight of these dolls. And you're right, really creepy. And this is typically gothic, actually, isn't it? The idea of the inanimate may somehow suddenly become animate.
No, the rabbit is definitely, it's giving me the evil eye. Some people have left messages as well. Here's one in, I guess, a sort of childish hand. To Annie and all the other little children who are here. Love from Rebecca Coverley. I'm not sure what other little children are here, but I'm hoping we don't run into them on the stairwell.
You go under dark arches and down dark stairs and alleys. The way is so narrow that you can lay a hand on either wall. So steep that in the greasy winter weather, the pavement is almost as treacherous as ice.
My name is Luke Harding. I was, until earlier this year, the Moscow correspondent for The Guardian, and I'm sitting in the Pine Bar of the Millennium Hotel in central London, in Mayfair. This bar is famous as the place where, almost 5 years ago, Alexander Litvinenko, the FSB officer turned dissident, was allegedly poisoned with some radioactive tea containing polonium-210. Now, I arrived in Moscow for The Guardian in the beginning of 2007. There was a major international scandal which kind of grew out of what happened in the bar here where I'm sitting. And suddenly it looked like Britain and Russia were once more kind of locked in Cold War battle mode, where I became the subject of surveillance and intimidation by the FSB, which is the successor agency to the KGB and the same organisation which was allegedly involved in Alexander Litvinenko's murder.
Last December, Alexander Litvinenko was laid to rest in London's Highgate Cemetery in a lead-lined coffin. One of the most active Russian dissidents of his generation, Litvinenko was poisoned with a radioactive cup of tea.
I found myself summoned by the FSB to their investigations bureau into Lefortovo, which is a notorious KGB prison. And I was being expelled, the first Western journalist actually to be kicked out of Russia since the Soviet Union.
A more important thing is that you've got special warning. According to the article 18-2 of the Penal Code of the Russian Federation.
Yeah, okay, fine. Where are we going with this conversation? Let's just keep talking. I don't quite understand.
Luke Harding, who wrote a book about his experiences, Mafia State. We interviewed Luke just as our hugely successful autumn book season was getting underway. So successful, in fact, that Russia's state television channel took an interest, and we rather wonderfully managed to smuggle Luke onto Russian TV with a copy of Vasily Grossman's Life and Fate under one arm and Mafia State under the other. But that's enough trumpet blowing. There's a serious side to our foreign travels, which is that we're trying to reflect all of literature and not just that of our own language. This is also the project of poet Alice Oswald, who this year has produced her own interpretations of both Homer and Tagore.
Far away under a different sky, the Padma is wandering. Her left side is sandbanks, rootless, moodless, bold in their bareness. Her right side is heavy with groves, bamboos and mangoes, old bunions and tumble-down houses, crooked jack trees with fat trunks, a field of mustard by a pond. There are low jungles of reeds and indigo factories with no roof or walls, tall casuarinas rustling in the gardens night and day. And there's the village of the Raj Bangshis, where goats graze on cracked fields, and a granary with a tin roof in the market. People stand there looking tense and strained, with one eye always on the river. This is the Padma, the otherworldly river. This is the Mandakini, the river of songs. She is free of us, she passes by, she endures our towns but never looks at them. She is the mountain's voice, the granite poem being carried word perfect to the sea.
I was so pleased to see the article was doing justice to Tagore, and I was so outraged by the end of it, because I completely agree that poetry in translation is problematic, if not impossible. But actually, poetry always starts with impossibility. And I think to say it's impossible is a starting point rather than a point of surrender. And certainly with Tagore, it is worth just dismantling that impossibility. So I've done a translation of a translation.
I see. Okay, so that's you're at two removes, aren't you, from the original text. And what relationship then do the words that you've produced have to Tagore's original words?
Well, probably at this point they are quite removed, but I have a great trust that if you open your mind properly to another writer, even a writer in another language, something, if you read enough around the subject, if you speak, in fact, to enough people who do speak Bengali, something will come across. And I think it's important anyway, when you're translating, to fix on the liveliness of the poem rather than all the sort of twists and turns of the style. So I hope that I've found what I find lively about Tagore and put it into my own words.
The poem that you've translated, it's about a river, the River Padma. And anyone who knows your work will know that rivers are a rich source of inspiration for you. The poem that you've produced, do you see it as your poem or do you see it as his?
I see it very much as Tagore's poem, and that I've learnt something from it. But I suppose my own experience of rivers and my love of rivers has made me feel able to join in with Tagore in his celebration of that river.
So it's a conversation then?
Yeah, I think so.
Alice Oswald, writing in English for those of us who don't read Bengali. But we British have also been warned that English literature no longer belongs to us alone. There's a growing number of African writers who go further than that. They say all Europeans should stop writing in any language about Africa now. We're in a post-colonial period. At the forefront of them is Binyavanga Wainaina.
My job wasn't police you. It was a tongue-in-cheek thing that anybody who's brought up consuming Western media, Western fiction, and Western things about Africa, which all of us do, and which people in the West don't get. The imagination is when a book is reviewed, they say we. They're assuming a certain we that doesn't include them. But remember, Britain had many colonies. And even just the trash of Britain lands in those colonies, leaving alone the good things. They're in our bookshops, they're in our imaginations, they're in our lives. So we consume them just like they're consumed here. And the average British reader has not got the beginning of a way to conceive of you. You'd struggle to find any significant books that come out of Britain about us. And so it becomes a question of how and why Britain itself has not been able to produce literature that's global, even though it had a global empire. It is producing really amazing work that can speak to the diversity within Britain. I can read it because I'm familiarized, but as a writer, I recognize that it's still indigestible. And there are Kenyans who are English-speaking Kenyans and educated Kenyans who will not and cannot get the codes. But we now get the codes of American stuff.
But because it's everywhere in Hollywood, on the TV.
So the generation of my dad could have gotten the English codes. We can't anymore. Yeah.
I'm wondering if people have stopped asking you to read their stuff after your second article about how to write about Africa. If people have stopped asking you to police their stuff to give you the seal of approval.
The point about it is that it hits the guilt button as opposed to the thinking button. It hits reactions rather than actions. And so it was there for people to think about and talk about and engage with. And it sort of freezes people like deer in the headlight. And then they're like, oh, God. I even got once a call from somebody in Oxfam who was like, they wanted me to advise. To what? Advise what? Why would you need advising? You're doing what you do. You're funded by the British government. It helps Britain look good. It helps you feel good. It doesn't really make my world a better place. You know that. What this whole world does not do is it does not engage us and our brains. It just comes with little kind of patronizing bullet points to a planet. And then you sit as a writer with somebody across, you know, some microphone. And then they're like, explain to me how. And then I'm like, shit, I'm now back in kindergarten. As many Africans always feel, you're in kindergarten explaining yourself to somebody who wants to receive kindergarten things. And then they want to tell you their heart is good. And I'm like, I don't care if your heart is good. I don't care if it's bad. That's not what the conversation's about.
So who exactly is allowed to write about what? We at the Guardian Books podcast rather believe that anyone should be able to write about anything and in any format. Which brings us to one of the year's running themes, the future of the book. I went to a UNESCO conference in Italy in the spring to find out what was happening around the world. And one of the people I talked to was the president of International Pen, John Ralston Saul.
I would say that a lot of the experts, particularly the ones who are very excited about technology, have absolutely no idea what a book is and don't read. Some of them don't seem to understand the nature of freedom of expression. They just see it as a technical problem or a commercial problem. And of course, we'll exist whether the commerce is there or not. We'll find a way. We're the people who have to find the way and break through. And there are some courageous publishers who are like that and some courageous journalists who are like that.
And off he rushed to answer another international phone call and engage in the worldwide battle. He's not terribly optimistic. But there are optimists, plenty of writers among them, who've already engaged in the new media with gusto. Foremost at this conference was Harvard professor Robert Darnton.
In general, I'm trying to get across the notion that we live in a complicated time, obviously, but there's a tendency today to over-dramatize the nature of things, you know, to say the book is dead. I have been invited to so many conferences on the death of the book that I think it's very much alive. There are more books being published each year than the year before worldwide. In the year 2011, there will be at least 1 million new titles published. And in Britain, you had the famous Super Thursday last October. You published 800 new books in one day. The production of books in Britain has gone up 40% since, I think, 2001. I'm not saying that things are booming. I know that publishers complain about hard times, but the fact is that the good old venerable codex, the printed codex, is doing very well, thank you. So I think that people are misled when they say the book is dead. And similarly, you often hear it said, all information is available online. That's absurd. Anyone who's done research in archives knows that a fraction of material has been read, not to mention reproduced.
Well, we're with Robert Darnton, who's heading up an amazing project to digitise the whole of American literature. On a humbler level, we're doing what we can to embrace every new technique for celebrating a writer's work. New to us this year is the audio tour. We've made four of them in the run-up to the Dickens bicentenary celebrations. We've been to London 3 times and Rochester, and we've plans for Portsmouth and York in the new year. Of course, you do need that modern device, the MP3 player, iPod or iPhone. But assuming you have one, why not walk off all that Christmas excess by taking a stroll through Dickens's London along the Oliver Twist Trail?
Although Oliver had enough to occupy his attention in keeping sight of his leader, he could not help bestowing a few hasty glances on either side of the way as he passed along. A dirtier or more wretched place he had never seen. The street was very narrow and muddy, and the air was impregnated with filthy odours. There were a good many small shops, but the only stock in trade appeared to be heaps of children, who, even at that time of night, were crawling in and out at the doors or screaming from the inside. The sole places that seemed to prosper amid the general blight of the place were the public houses, and in them, the lowest orders of Irish were wrangling with might and main. Covered ways and yards, which here and there diverged from the main street, disclosed little knots of houses where drunken men and women were positively wallowing in filth. And from several of the doorways, great ill-looking fellows were cautiously emerging, bound to all appearance on no very well-disposed or harmless errands.
By now, I hope you've made it down the alleyway at the back of the former Guardian offices. And if you look in the road outside the Coach and Horses pub, you'll see a drain. Take a listen. Veronica, can you tell me why we're standing in the middle of a busy road listening to a drain?
Because that isn't a drain. That's the Fleet River down there. Of course, it's a sewer and a stormwater overflow now, but it was originally a river that rose on Hampstead Heath, flowed southwards, took a wiggle eastwards quite near where we are, ran right underneath here, and by the way, this area was much lower, much, much, much lower. It was called Hockley at the Hole, and it didn't come lower than that. And then turned south again to flow into the Thames by modern Blackfriars Bridge. By the 18th century, let alone by Dickens's time, it was an open ditch, and by the time of Oliver Twist, it was an uncovered sewer. This whole area around here was the worst kind of criminal slum. There were lots of rookeries in London, and Dickens knew them all, although he would hardly have gone into them alone.
It was dangerous. I mean, it was a dangerous area.
It was truly dangerous. The Guardian, I have always been delighted to say, stands on the site of a medieval dung heap where the offal from Smithfield used to be thrown. And where we're going to turn into now was also a rookery. Indeed, it was Fagin's rookery.
When I was 17, I drank some very good beer. I drank some very good beer I purchased with a fake ID. My name
was a mess of good years.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1 month, no commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.